Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Monday, December 23rd, Joe was joined by Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, Senior Fellow at Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, Political Consultant and Lobbyist, Libby Post, and an Associate Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College, and since 2023, she has been President of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Riedel.
The other story that I mentioned that is breaking just within the... it's not really breaking news, but you know what I mean. In the sense that this is just...
He's such a loser.
We're talking about Matt Gaetz, and we're talking about the ethics report, and this is a sort of a long and winding road. However, this report, by the way, the long and winding road is so long, I'm only going to talk about a portion of the road, but once he dropped out for the AG, and then they said, should we release the report? And they all said no. And then he said he wasn't going to run. He could have, I guess, served his term.
But he resigned before.
Correct. Right. But he could have served his next term, and he decided not to do that. And then he removed himself from pretty much from anything D.C. related, and then became an anchor on OAN and One American News Network and OANN. And now they said they weren't going to release the report, and then we found out last week that they the House committee secretly voted and said that they should release the report and profile and courage. When were they going to release the report? When everybody was home. By the minute all the legislators were done with the budget, they averted a shutdown, and everybody made their connecting flights, and then that's when they announced it. The House Ethics Committee found evidence that former Representative Matt Gaetz paid tens of thousands of dollars to women for sex or drugs on at least 20 occasions, including paying a 17-year-old girl for sex in 2017, according to a final draft of the panel's report on the Florida Republican. I will say, as I read some of this, it is troubling. There's some things here that are just rather... horrible, but so just a slight warning on that. Nothing that has really not been reported before, but still. The committee concluded in its document that Gaetz violated Florida state laws, including the state's statutory rape law, as the GOP-led panel chose to take the rare step of releasing a report after a former member who resigned from Congress. The panel investigated transactions that Gaetz personally made, often using PayPal or Venmo, to more than a dozen women during his time in Congress, according to the report. The committee determined that there is substantial evidence that Representative Gaetz violated House rules and other standards of conduct prohibiting prostitution, statutory rape, illicit drug use, impermissible gifts, special favors or privileges, and obstruction of Congress. Hell of a list. So, here's just some of the sort of details here. According to the report, investigators focused on a 2018 trip to the Bahamas, which they said violated the House gift rule, during which he engaged in sexual activity with multiple women, including one who described the trip itself as, quote, the payment for sex on the trip. On the same trip, he also took ecstasy, according to the woman speaking to the committee. Earlier this month, the House Ethics Committee secretly voted to release the report, as I mentioned. Gaetz has repeatedly denied any wrongdoing and has pointed to the Justice Department declining to bring charges against him in 2023. He said last week, in my single days, I often sent funds to women I dated, even some I never dated. But who asked? I never dated, but who asked? I dated several of these women for years. It's embarrassing, though not criminal, that I probably partied, womanized, drank, and smoked more than I should have earlier in my life. I live a different life now. Although the committee alleged that Gates violated state laws, the panel wrote that it did not find Gates violated federal sex trafficking laws, writing that although Representative Gates did cause the transportation of women across state lines for purposes of commercial sex, the committee did not find evidence that any of those women were under 18 at the time of travel, nor did the committee find sufficient evidence to conclude that the commercial sex acts were induced by force, fraud, or coercion. One of the sexual encounters did involve a 17-year-old girl, the committee said. The woman told the committee that she had sex with Gates twice at a party in 2017 when she was 17. The committee received testimony that victim A and Representative Gates had sex twice during the party, including at least once in the presence of another party attendee. Victim A recalled receiving $400 in cash from Gates that evening, which she understood to be a payment for sex. At the time, she had just completed her junior year of high school. Gross. The then 17-year-old did not tell Gates she was a minor at the time, and he did not ask her age, according to the committee. Gates has denied having sex with a minor ever, according to this report. And then it just gets really muddy in the sense of the payments. There's this other guy, Greenberg, who is a part of it, and the payments that came in PayPal and Cash App and Venmo. And they found at least 12 payments that were made to 12 women, including to his former girlfriend, who often would assist in setting up and participating with him in the sexual encounters and was active on the website to make these sex for money arrangements. I'm done. And by the way, Matt, maybe now is the time to just mention that a month ago, he was the nominee to be the Attorney General of the United States of America. Yeah. There you go, Jim.
Oh, sure. Throw it to me. Thank you.
Sorry. You can defer to anyone you wish.
Well, you know, it is important to remember that we've always had criminals, scoundrels, et cetera, in political office. But this guy really sets a new very low standard. I mean, so low that I think the reason that the report was released, even though it was released when people were scurrying out and on their way home, is that he's absolutely detested by almost all of his colleagues, even from his own party. And all of those things you were talking about, Joe, those really kind of disgusting, vulgar details. None of it's really a surprise, but what continues to be a surprise to me, and I suppose that it shouldn't, is that somebody who is a known character like this was elected and reelected and reelected and nominated to be the Attorney General of the United States. I think it's just a further manifestation of this kind of hyper partisanship that people will vote for the person of their party no matter what level of criminal and disgusting behavior they've been involved in.
Can I just add one thing, Jim, that to my knowledge, and you can correct me if I'm, any of you can correct me if I'm wrong in this, but while this report was released, the committee knew what was in the report, and no action was taken then. I mean, they were going to release it later, but they were doing the investigation. But just the fact that this had gone on and basically could have just gone away is really amazing.
Yeah, amazing is one word for it. And I mean, the last thing I'll say before I turn it over to my colleagues is that this also just, you know, is another, I think, just yet another very hard hit on our institutions. And what you were just saying, Joe, is, in, you know, to what extent can our institutions police themselves? Can they, you know, what level of terrible behavior do you have to engage in to be cast out in one way or another? And, you know, I just feel like our democratic institutions are kind of hanging by a thread anyway. They're seen as so delegitimized in the eyes of people on both sides of the aisle. And this is, I think this is just going to continue to do damage to the overall profile and perception of the effectiveness of our institutions and their legitimacy.
Okay.
And everything you've said becomes more and more normalized, right? As a result of it. I think you said it very well, Jim, that it goes way beyond the just this one particular representative whose background is clearly very questionable. And it's an illustration of how our political environment is changing and doesn't reflect. During the break, we're talking about the 1980s and how the focus back then was truly still on policy and how representatives still had a lot of room for maneuver to really represent their constituents, but also pursue their ideologies and beliefs. And all of that is just gone at this point, where representatives don't have a lot of room for maneuver anymore. And at the same time, political decisions are driven purely by partisan considerations.
Hard to, yeah, go on from there. Malia.
Yeah, I was looking back at some of the news stories from when the Department of Justice decided not to charge Gates, right? Because clearly there's a lot of evidence in this report that Gates has engaged in some horrific wrongdoing for a long time. And so I was like, you know, why was he not charged? And so this is from February of last year. When senior DOJ officials made a final decision not to move forward with any charges against him. And that was after some of the prosecutors working on the case back in fall of 2022 had recommended against charging him because of questions over whether witnesses would be perceived as credible before a jury. You know, I agree with what Jim was saying about, you know, the credibility of our institutions. And I've just been really perplexed by a lot of actions the Department of Justice has taken over the past couple of years, or I should say not just the actions they've taken, the actions they declined to take, the general slowness. Now, I know the wheels of justice turn slowly, and they have to be very careful in constructing cases. But we've seen a number of very high-profile cases that the DOJ was involved in or preparing to bring forward or decided not to bring forward, and that just have not, from my point of view, have not seemed to really advance justice on behalf of the American people in ways I would expect. And so I don't know what this report that's coming out today portends for Matt Gaetz in terms of, like, criminal wrongdoing, because, you know, federal prosecutors have already declined, you know, over a year ago to do anything against him. So if there are any lawyers listening to this who can explain this, I would love for them to write in. I'm just really, as I said, perplexed by how the DOJ has not taken action.
Libby Post.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, so sorry, Malia, but from my perspective, this is just the continued institutionalization of toxic masculinity. The fact that the the committee, oh, we're not going to release it. And then they do release it in a way that, you know, shields everybody, right? We have a predator in chief that's going to be sworn in on January 20th. He's been found liable, okay? I mean, I don't want to do the Jared Stephanopoulos thing, but the civil court judge did say that he's liable for rape, and we know that he boasted about grabbing women by their genitals during the before the 2016 campaign. That's what came out, and you know that was the October surprise, which didn't surprise anybody, I guess. So you know, this whole thing, we have a culture now that is sort of bucking up this toxic masculinity. We're returning to the 50s, folks, and we have to, you know, not do that. And when women speak out about this, they're poo-pooed now. I mean, I remember when women would speak out about this and people would pay attention and people would take it seriously. And now it's not, oh, it's not that serious. You know, these women are liberated and this is what they wanted to do. You know, and that's and the fact is that one of these women was 17. He plied them with drugs. He took drugs himself. I mean, this is a man that upholds moral Christian values, right? He's a darling of the right, although nobody really likes him. But that's the way he's always portrayed himself. And here is the evidence. And what's going to happen to Matt Gaetz? Oh, well, he'll go be an anchor someplace. He'll end up in the administration at some point. In a position that doesn't have to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm just going to add again, building on what both of you have said. He's clearly done enough that should keep him from the public space, but it may not. But I celebrate the fact that the report has been released in order to document what has happened for historical purposes, where our memories are just don't work that way anymore, that we remember stories that have been told. It has to be documented, and the release of the report has done precisely that.
That was Dr. Karen Riedel on the Roundtable panel on Monday, December 23rd. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, December 26th, Joe was out and Sarah LaDuke hosted. She was joined by preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman.
Let us begin talking about the first story for this morning. Setup to talk about more things. It's a media story. Kara Swisher wants to buy the Washington Post. This was reported first by Axios. Veteran tech reporter Kara Swisher is aiming to put together a team of investors to purchase the Washington Post from Jeff Bezos. Swisher is one of the best-known and busiest tech reporters in the world. She currently co-hosts the Pivot podcast with NYU professor Scott Galloway, as well as her On with Kara Swisher podcast. She's an editor-at-large for New York Magazine, and also has ties to the Washington Post. She started the newspaper's mailroom and later moved up to becoming a tech reporter for the outlet. Her push to acquire the Post comes after Bezos recently said he was very proud of the paper not endorsing a presidential candidate in the 2024 election. Heading into this election, the Washington Post had endorsed every Democratic candidate since 1988. The biggest hurdle to Swisher or anyone else who wants to buy the paper is that Bezos has not given any indication that he wants to sell it. The Amazon founder bought the Washington Post for $250 million in 2013, And Axios reported that Swisher is confident the money is there if Bezos ultimately feels like making a deal. Mark.
I thought this was a very interesting story, Sarah. Who knows how much truth there is to it, but I thought it touches on a lot of really interesting elements that sort of summarize much of what we've seen in 24 and what we're going to see in 25. First of all, there's the issue of Bezos sort of forever sullying the Washington Post by stepping in at the last moment and quashing the editorial, which would have likely endorsed Vice President Harris for president. And I think now that he's done that, so long as he's the owner, there's no going back, or at least it would take an inordinate amount of time for that paper to resuscitate its image fully. And he certainly lost a lot of personnel, a lot of respected personnel as a result of that decision. Now, it's clear why he made it. He's trying to cuddle up to a new president who he, at the time he feared would become president, who is going to play a very active role in deciding winners and losers economically in this country and actually around the world, which I think is one of the big risks that we face in 2025. So I thought the story was interesting in that way. I think Fisher herself is very bright and insightful. I enjoy her writings. I don't know why it is that she thinks she's a better operator of a newspaper, although she would, a new group, even if it kept the same managerial staff in place, would remove the taint that Bezos has forever saddled his business with. I also think it's interesting, it wasn't reported in this story, but there were rumors that Elon Musk had approached Fisher and said he wanted to be part of the group and that he was rebuffed. One thing, if you think about Elon Musk, having bought Twitter, he lost about $30 billion in value. If you take a rough guess, he paid about $44 for it. It's probably worth about $10 or maybe a little bit less right now. But you know what? Because we now have a president who's deciding winners and losers, and he's got SpaceX and Tesla, that $30 billion probably was a tiny, worthwhile investment for what he's going to garnish in terms of favor from the president. And I'm not sure that he's in the same position to do that if he doesn't own Twitter. So I thought the story is an interesting and really sort of sad microcosm of where we stand in terms of journalism and economics. And maybe I'll leave it to other panelists to talk about, you know, how this relates to ABC and those threats. But I thought this was an interesting story.
Terry Gibson.
Well, I do think it's an interesting reflection on where we stand in the media landscape today, which I think everyone working in the media, everyone that owns a media outlet, whether it's large or small, understands that the future is really unclear. It's unclear how both large and small media outlets will continue to make a profit, how they will continue to draw an audience, how they will compete with the significant competition that's going to come from many different types of AI-generated media content. So the timing of it doesn't surprise me. What I am wondering about is what motivation Jeff Bezos would even have to consider selling it to this entity or to anyone for that matter. I can't believe that Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post for a profit. I can't imagine that's incredibly important to him. It's not as if he needs the money, but what he does need is the status. He needs the status. He needs the connections that ownership gives him. And I think Mark alluded to some of that. Certainly when you own one of the largest media outlets, it does give you a lot of leverage. And certainly Jeff is using that with President Trump right now, much like Elon Musk is using his leverage with Twitter with Donald Trump right now. I was glad to hear that Musk was sort of rebuffed from this group. The last thing I think we want is for Musk to take on yet another media entity and destroy it. And speaking of destroying it, I just do wonder. I think it's just too soon to tell. But I do think that what Bezos did in terms of refusing to endorse, I think it did really taint the brand of the Washington Post. And what I'm wondering is if it tainted it so much that even a new group buying it, if they can even actually rebrand it. I think they probably can, but I think whether Bezos owns it or doesn't own it, the sort of negative implications that his decision gave that brand, I think are going to stick with it, even with new ownership. So it's going to make the challenge of rebranding it even harder.
Heather Mulligan is the CEO of the Business Council of New York State, and she joins us morning, Heather.
Hi.
What do you think about the Washington Post?
So I think I'm going to step right in it and say I don't necessarily agree with some of the... First off, I started off looking at this. I'm like, Kara Swisher, like, why? Isn't she an Olympian or something? You know, I don't know why. My brain, I do this. My husband would laugh if he heard me saying this because I mix people up and I assign them entire biographies that are completely made up inside my own head. So I'm like,
you should stop doing that.
I'm like, I think she was like one of the U.S. soccer team players or something. No, not at all. But anyways, first off, I think the Washington Post, the expectation that they would, and they have never endorsed a Republican, the expectation that they would automatically endorse a Democrat, the fact that they didn't, I think, actually gave them some credibility, personally. On the right, people think, oh, the Washington Post, New York Times, these are completely controlled by the left. They will only ever endorse a Democrat. They are there to regurgitate every left liberal concept and will ignore the stories that are harmful to Democrats. And there's definitely some evidence of that. The fact that they didn't endorse automatically, pro forma, the Democratic nominee this time around, I think actually gave them some credibility. Now, you could dig a little deeper into that and say, except you look at who owns it. It's a tech guy. He's terrified. He thinks that, you know, there's a possibility that Trump is going to win. I'm sure we're looking at polling numbers. I think the New York Times was completely caught off guard, but the Washington Post may have had, you know, better insight into the state of, because they're not located inside the shiny blue bubble that we live in. But anyways, I think, you know, certainly he was doing some hedging of bets, and the fact that the owner himself, you know, was responsible for pulling it, that does very much undermine what I just asserted, right? Sure. So, and I understand that. But I think, like, broadly speaking, the expectation that they would always endorse a Democrat is not good for the brand in a country that not overwhelmingly, but by a majority voted for a Republican and is unhappy with the Democratic brand. If you want media to gain its credibility back, they need to start being more centrist and you know, not as far right or far left as a lot of the media outlets are. But all that being said, Kara Swisher is, I mean, motivated in part because she is extremely far left. She got, I guess, in trouble for urging her Twitter followers to come up with a nickname for Ramaswamy, which ended up being Ramaswarmy, which, you know, she was accused of that being sort of racist.
Xenophobic. Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, if you haven't heard that story, well, I think that just proves my point, right? That it was not something that was widely covered by the media, but certainly not a good reflection. And there's numerous examples of her really saying some very offensive things, including using a lot of really foul language on her show, and really going, I would say, over the top against folks on who are more on the right side of the aisle. So, I mean, there's a lot more to this in terms of motivations. And I was really curious when I heard one of my other panelists talking about Elon Musk. Let's not forget, Elon Musk bought Twitter not because he wanted to make money, but because he wanted to protect free speech and save the world from itself. So, you know, I think on some level fully believes that he is the white knight coming in to save media. And it does seem to me to be a little bit of a parallel to Kara Swisher wanting to come in and buy the Washington Post.
Mark?
Well, a couple things. Back to Terry's comments. Terry, I think the reason that it's not inconceivable Bezos sells is because he's now in this position where if the Washington Post says anything negative about Trump, he's got the risk that Trump turns to him and criticizes him. And he can no longer say, I just bought it and I leave it alone. I never interfere, because he's interfered. So there's always the expectation that he would do it again if there's enough pressure to have him interfere. And he's got SpaceX. He's got Amazon and particularly issues around labor there. And then also he's got the cloud service, all of which interact with the government in meaningful ways. As to Kara Swisher, I agree with the criticism that she is far too often far too personal in her attacks on those she disagrees with. I don't find that particularly helpful when she does it, and sometimes I have found it disagreeable. But she's incredibly insightful, and she understands of what she speaks. I think the fallacy or the fantasy that that somehow it was the Washington Post that decided not to endorse Kamala Harris, I think it misses the point. It was Jeff Bezos. He stepped in, and he changed the experiment. And so there's always going to be the expectation they do it again. I agree. Musk, you know, has a profit, nonprofit motive in what he did with Twitter. But you don't cut all the employees if you have a nonprofit motive.
Right,
and,
yeah.
And you don't, my understanding is, both with respect to debt and with respect to Morgan Stanley's banking fees, he's sort of pushed back on, let's say, making everybody as whole as they might be at this point, because he realizes that he was sort of encouraged to make what turned out initially to be a really stupid investment. But I think it's worked out for him, because I think the platform that gave him magnified his ability to cozy up to Trump. And if I'm Bezos saying, I've got this same thing, but it's an anvil every time I turn around, I do think Swisher's thinking ahead when she says, gee, there might be a chance when Bezos says, yeah, I just want out, because even if I lose money on the sale, it's freeing me of this is going to help Blue Origin or the cloud business or something else so profoundly. I think it's a sad state, and I also think it's talks about the attacks on the media that the Trump administration has already started, and unfortunately they've been effective.
Leap back into the topic we were discussing before the news break with this letter from Mike in Albany, who says, "Dear panel, one of the primary reasons why billionaire oligarchs like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk seek out ownership of media entities, whether they be prestige properties like the Washington Post or more newfangled things like Twitter/X, is to exert control over political narratives. If politics is basically a discussion over how we should allocate resources to organize our society, of course the richest people are going to dominate these discussions and stamp out any arguments toward a more equitable, moral, rational, and downward distribution, let alone any government intervention in our lives. One of the primary functions of the media is to tell us how we should feel about any given issue. Controlling this ability is a pretty powerful thing." Terry.
I would find it hard to disagree with that letter writer. I think they make very, very good points. I was just thinking back to some of the things my fellow panelists said this morning. One of them was related to just the perception of these brands. I think Heather had mentioned that the idea that the Washington Post didn't automatically endorse Kamala Harris was upsetting, at least for me. It wasn't so much that, it was that we learned that there apparently was a decision made to endorse her, and that decision had already resulted in, I guess, a draft of the actual editorial where they were going to do that, and at the last minute it was pulled. I feel it's just the sort of machinations behind the scenes there that at least left me with a bad taste about how things were running at that outlet. I would have, if they had decided to endorse Trump, or if they had decided to not endorse and wrote an editorial that really explained their decision behind that, I think I personally would have found that a little bit more accepting. I also think that that brand itself is one that does attract a more left-leaning audience, and has for a long period of time, just like Fox News attracts a more right-leaning audience, and the New York Post attracts a more right-leaning audience. I'm not sure if changing ownership will matter. For instance, if the New York Post changed ownership or Fox News changed ownership, for someone like me, it would take me quite a while to come around to going to them on a daily basis as my news source, even if the ownership had changed to maybe a more liberal ownership. I think these brands have really sort of a legacy status that makes it really hard to sort of change how people view them, regardless of who owns them. So I back to sort of Kara Swisher taking this over. I do think that's one of the challenges she's going to face, is that whatever those left-leaning audiences think about the Post, they may still continue to have reservations regardless of who owns it. I also just think that we are at kind of a sad place in the media world, when it's becoming clear that unless you can operate your outlet and significantly biased fashion and find a way to use it to gain political clout, then your very existence might be in jeopardy. And I think we're going to see more and more of that as we move into the Trump administration's second term.
Mark or Heather?
I appreciate the letter writer's skepticism, but I think it's overdone. I think if you look at Bezos, he was trying to be in the history of William Randolph Hearst and others. I do think there is a bit of a marquee value to these properties. And Bezos said he wasn't going to interfere with the Post and that he wanted to save it and operate it. I think people like Bezos and even Musk are a swirl of different views of the world, as we all are, some of which are perfectly aligned, some of which aren't. I think Musk did want to be a radical free speech advocate, and he wanted to advocate for Musk speech. And those things don't necessarily correlate, or those things sometimes come into conflict. And certainly you see his biases when those conflicts arise. But I don't think people are of as a singular a purpose as the letter writer suggests. And I also do think you see this trend in America where these wealthy, we'll call them robber barons for lack of a better term, once they reach a certain status and level of wealth, they do sort of start to try and burnish their image. Or we could say it less cynically, they do try and spread the largesse and do some good. But that's, of course, only after they've amassed ungodly sums of money and done so in many cases through pretty questionable means. So I think to say that Jeff Bezos did it so that he could influence the world to his way of thinking might be an overstatement in the case of Amazon. In the case of Musk, I think it's truer, a statement, or a more true statement. But I do think these people, just like all of us, are sort of these whirling nexuses of ideas, and they don't necessarily all comport with one another.
Heather.
So I just want to say I actually agree with Terry and Mark on this, and also on the side commentary, which I thought I kind of acknowledged when I said, you know, with regard to the pulling of the endorsement, you know, the fact that he was involved in it sort of undermines any argument that they should get some kind of credibility for it, although that was probably the part of the intent. And the other part, as I mentioned, is him sort of covering his rear end a little bit and hedging his bets in case, you know, the election didn't end up being won by a Democrat. But, I tend to not believe that people are quite as I don't know, evil as is suggested by the writer. I think that I do think that it's a lot easier to be generous and beneficent when you have a couple $1 billion in your bank account. And, you know, probably these guys should be even more generous. But
probably.
Yeah.
probably they could afford to be.
But I do think that they get to a point where they start thinking about their own legacy, and they don't want it to be one of being described as a robber baron. They want to be described as someone who had a good influence on the world. And certainly Elon has said that about himself a number of times. I'm sure Bezos is thinking that on some level, and certainly his former wife. I mean, she's just trying to give all of it away. So that's a good thing. And I know that I think all three, I'm not actually positive about Musk, but at least Bezos is part of the billionaire's pledge to give, you know, a huge amount of their money to charity.
That was Heather Mulligan on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, December 26th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, December 27th, Joe was out and Sarah LaDuke hosted. She was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Ulster County Comptroller and the former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, and Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Henler.
President Joe Biden secured the 235th judicial confirmation of his presidency on December 20th. That number of appointments exceeds his predecessor's total by one after Democrats put extra emphasis on the federal courts following Donald Trump's far-reaching first term, where he filled three seats on the Supreme Court. New York Democrat Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer teed up votes on two California district judges, and they were the last judicial confirmations this year before Congress adjourned and made way for the new Republican-led Senate next term. The confirmation of Serena Raquel Murillo as a district judge for the Central District of California broke Trump's mark. The tally also marks the largest number of confirmations in a single term since the Jimmy Carter administration. Come next year, Republicans will look to boost Trump's already considerable influence on the makeup of the federal judiciary in his second term. Teresa, you requested this topic. Let us begin with you.
Yeah, I think these are some data points that have... I think the Biden-Harris administration has had a number of accomplishments that we've really not documented in the way that it could or should be or would be in other circumstances. And this one, I think, will have a generational impact. And I think it's important for people to understand that it's not just the number of judges, which is historic, but it's the type, it's the diversity of the judges. It's diversity by profession. They are public defenders, civil rights lawyers, labor rights lawyers, teachers, and others. So they have a much broader background that they bring to the bench. But it's also a record number of African Americans, 56, 35 black women, 21 black men. There are 22 Asian females. There are 13 Hispanic males, 12 Asian males. And it's incredibly, there's a Navajo person for the first time ever.
Wow.
It's really, first of all, as I was reading the data, it's remarkable that the number of firsts, right? That shows we haven't come far. But the incredible reach and diversification of our judicial system has been remarkable. And just to give some comparison, Trump appointed two African-Americans when he was president the last time. President Obama, 26. As compared to President Biden, 63. And so he pledged to do this. He did it methodically. His administration was on it. And I also think that really high praise needs to go to Senator Schumer and his staff, who day by day, week by week, aggressively worked to bring these nominations to the Senate floor and get them approved. And it will really make a difference in the courts because you have a much more diversity of thought and experience and background that you bring to the bench.
March?
So I had to think for myself, like, well, it's great that we've, you know, filled a lot of positions in the courts, but what good are judges if nobody abides by the rule of law? And, you know, they have the Supreme Court, the Republican majority, and it's a very conservative court. And it made me think about Amy Coney Barrett. I mean, she honestly has, even though she's really voted with the conservative bench, she's indicated that there is a possibility that she's a little bit more moderate than we expected, especially on certain issues that could concern the rule of law. So I don't know where that's going to go. Senator Grassley said, you know, in 2029, Trump will be bragging about having appointed, you know, 240 people to the bench, right? So this is going to be an ever-escalating sort of race that I think is possible over the next, you know, certainly the next administration because we have so many aging people on the bench. I am excited about the diversity brought to the bench. As Teresa said, you know, both in people's ethnic and, you know, their background, but also their profession, right? Coming from civil rights, coming as public defenders, lawyers, labor attorneys. And I just want to say the way I see it, because I think there's a lot of people out there who will look at the list and say, this is a DEI effort, okay? And that those words have really been discredited. And I just want to say, I don't see it that way. I see it differently. What I see is we have a tremendous pool of talent that is not white and not white male in America, and we have undervalued it and underutilized it. And this was an effort to make good on including all of the talent possible. So to those people who say it's DEI appointments, you're wrong. Thank you.
Jim?
That's hard to follow.
Sorry.
Well, no, I mean, because it's completely true. But the other thing is, it's really going to be interesting to see how it plays out over time, because not just the number of appointments, but where those appointments are, how they fall, things like that, really make a lot of difference. And it really now, when you look at the map of what judges are where, right, you're not like seeing, you know, conservative judges in red states and progressive judges, quote unquote, in blue states, but a real mix. Of course, a few of the most visible cases will end up in the Supreme Court. And this is, as several people have said, you know, there's a lot of question about the quality of this Supreme Court and its members. There's a lot of questions about whether some of the older conservative members will be willing to step down to let Trump take their place. I mean, the real question is Clarence Thomas willing to give up the vacations or not? But it's going to be an interesting time. And I think, you know, one of the things that's really important is that a lot of Trump's super over-excessive attempts the first term were stopped by the federal judiciary. He tried to fix that by putting lots of people on the federal judiciary and trying to put them in places where they could have a lot of effect. You know, if you actually look at the court, the cases that have gone up to the court, there's, I think, three or four of them that went through one particular Texas judge. We all know what happened in Florida when Trump was, quote, lucky enough, unquote, to get by the random drawing the one judge who was going to ignore the classified documents. Of course, there were only four judges there, and he had appointed her in particular. So, you know, it's really going to be interesting to see how this plays out. But I think the bizarre thing about it is it's one of these things that plays out over 20, 30 years and people don't really see it. Remember that these people who've just been appointed to a lower level federal bench are the ones who will then end up on appeals courts, state Supreme Courts, eventually perhaps Supreme Courts. And these are the places where those really big decisions come into play. So fingers crossed this will be a very positive thing.
That's why I thought it was so important to talk about, because this is something that will play out over many years in ways that won't be so obvious but will matter. And it's not only their what cases will come before them. All of that will be very important. But it's demonstrating by example that there are highly qualified people who are women, who are Muslim, who are Navajo or Hawaiian American, who are Asian American, who are African American, that can do this job, that they have the credentials. And then the other thing is, I know this is a bit Pollyannish, but it becomes aspirational for younger people to say, if you know, because it breaks that a glass ceiling that's been there. And so I think that this is the courts are the kind of thing, the focus is always on the Supreme Court, and as it should be, but these lower courts do matter, and it's an important achievement, and yes, I'm sure the Republicans will try to do the same. It's going to be up to the Democrats in the Senate to make sure that people who the Trump people bring forward are actually qualified, you know, advice and consent. We'll see how that goes. But I do think that this is an achievement worth noting. I appreciate we're taking time to talk about it because I think it will make a difference in ways that people won't even realize. But cheers to Biden. Cheers to Harris. Cheers to Schumer and their team.
According to Schumer, 1 in 4 active judges right now was appointed by Biden. So that's a pretty big number. And I also just want to note that, you know, Biden appointed Ketanji Brown Jackson twice, once to the Court of Appeals and once to the Supreme Court. And that was a really good move. you know, she's going to be great. She's going to be there a long time. And she's already making a huge difference.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation, should you wish to do so. Panel at WAMC.org. Liberal-leaning advocacy groups say they're delighted with the number of judges Democrats secured, but even more so with the quality of the nominees, as we've been saying. They said the diversity in personal and professional backgrounds, I'm reading way too fast, improves judicial decision-making, helps build public trust, and inspires people from all walks of life to pursue legal careers. So that's similar to what Teresa just said.
And, you know, we discussed this a lot during the first Trump years on the roundtable. I won't bring it all back up, but suffice to say that the Trump administration, during the 2 years they actually had control of the three houses, such as the next 2 years at least will be, during that time, they put through judges with some of the lowest ratings by the ABA that have ever been put on federal benches. I mean, they really were far more interested in the loyalty test than the quality test. And as far as I can tell, you know, from what I've read, I haven't really studied the Biden judges, but none of these judges seem to have gotten a low rating from the standard law ABA. And that, you should remember, is a group that has been around a long time, is largely dominated by white men, has not had a reputation as being a particularly liberal organization. So it really is a triumph. It is an important thing.
Well, thank goodness the Democrats got something done and they could actually talk about it.
Well, I think they, you know,
they had talked about it more.
Right. I'm of the mind, actually, that they did achieve a lot, and communications is the problem. But I think that's why I felt that this needed. And there's, you know, they laid a pretty strong foundation. But I think it's also worth noting that, you know, why does it matter about these courts? And it, particularly, it might matter in the coming years because so much of the public policy is going to be litigated, whether it's the clean air, clean water policy. It's because there's going to be the Trump administration and Project 2025, and they have promised an attack on regulatory issues and such. And so the courts, more and more frequently, is where a lot of our health care, you know, issues may be resolved. A lot of our environmental issues might be resolved. And, of course, civil rights and voting rights and so on and so forth. So that's why having this diversity of experience and thought and background on the federal courts, in the federal courts, really will, I think, make a difference, and is so important. And I also noted in reading a number of the people, the Trump administration, they're already whining because some of the federal judges who had anticipated stepping down have now withdrawn their resignations and are going to stay. So, yes, there are a number of potential slots that the Trump administration can fill, and I'm sure that there will be pressure on Republican-appointed judges who are older to step down. Certainly, you can see that coming at the Supreme Court level. But I think that this will have a quiet but influential impact.
March. Trump appointed 54 Court of Appeals judges, Biden only 45. Trump appointed 3 Supreme Court judges, justices, Biden only 1. So, you know, where you get your action matters, too. And having, you know, federal district court judges that are, you know, less amenable to Trump really may not matter if stuff is going up on appeal. So we're going to have to see how the whole thing plays out.
During the break, we were having kind of a juicy conversation about other things the Biden administration accomplished, including passing that giant infrastructure bill. Let's talk about it on mic instead. Go ahead, guys.
So Teresa asked me on the break if I thought the Biden, you know, was I saying the Biden administration hadn't accomplished a lot? And that's really not what I was saying. I was saying we don't talk about the accomplishments enough, which is why I really appreciate the topic of judicial appointments. But infrastructure bill, perfect example, the money hasn't really rolled out yet. And it's taking some time. Other federal money did get spent, things like, you know, COVID relief, ARPA, that sort of thing. And there wasn't really a lot of championing of that in Harris's campaign, I felt. I think that she really did not highlight all the positives that happened. And also, like, tremendous investments in things like chip fab and new technology and reshoring certain things. We didn't really hear about that as much as I would have liked. And infrastructure, unfortunately, is rolling out now. Trump is going to get credit for these infrastructure projects. I think one traffic light in Ulster County got done so far. And we're getting a lot more. It's going to be coming from that pool. So, yeah, talking about what you accomplished.
You got one, though.
where people have died, by the way.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, no, I'm saying it's a really important light. It's going to save lives. But talking about what
you got to get. Teresa and I both misinterpreted it.
What did you think I was saying?
We already interpreted it as they put up
they put in the light
in the wrong place.
No, they put it up in a great spot.
Good.
And
it was much needed to provide safety as it was intended.
Exactly. So that shows you communication really matters, and sometimes you say it wrong and people misunderstand you.
But money that did go out was, and there is so much more planned, unless if the Trump administration does what they pledged to do, which is what they quote unquote claw it all back. But funding for lead pipes, to clean lead pipes, right? That's a public health issue. It's an infrastructure issue. And a lot of that money has gone out the door, and more of it is scheduled to go out the door. The repairing and restoring bridges and roads and so on and so forth. And
broadband.
And this infrastructure funding not only improves communities, and they really did work to target it to those who need it most, right? And in fact, it went to a lot of red states because it was economically focused, right?
Mm-hmm.
And not only does it repair the infrastructure, but it provides lots of jobs. And so it's a jobs bill. It's an infrastructure bill. It has a generational impact. But also the Inflation Reduction Act, where Trump is pledging, you know, it's the climate change money. It's the, you know, to address climate change. And he's promising, and Project 2025 promises, and drill baby drill promises, we're going to, quote unquote, claw that money back. We're going to repeal it. So what if they do that?
You know, I'm scared about clawbacks,
that's
Teresa.
Dangerous.
We looked, you know, the Comptroller's Office in Ulster County, we looked at federal funding coming into Ulster County. It's around $50 million a year. That is not just because of COVID. You know, this kind of goes back. And, you know, as far as 2018, we were getting $50 million a year coming through Ulster County government. However, if you look at all federal money coming into the county, $2.4 billion a year. $1 billion in Social Security alone, over $600 million in Medicare, over $600 million in Medicaid. And when I saw the size of those numbers, I realized they can't cut this. It would devastate the economy in untold ways. And it actually gave me some solace. I was like, oh, they can't really do what they're talking about doing to the full extent that they've been talking about doing it. Will they claw back around the edges on certain things? Maybe they'll take some money back. Yes, they'll probably cut some programs, but those entitlement programs, I believe it's going to be very hard to cut.
That was March Gallagher on the Roundtable panel on Friday, December 27th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.